Conservation Commission, and she says the safety equipment did its job.
When you're drilling the surface hole in a well, you can't use a blowout preventer because there's no pipe to attach the blowout preventer to. So you have to use a diverter, and a diverter doesn't allow you to shut the well in. It just diverts flow away from the people in the rig. And this diverter did exactly what it was supposed to do.
The blowout sent about 40 barrels of drilling mud out of the well and onto the drilling platform, according to the state. Gas is still flowing from the well, and Forster says Repsol shut down the rig because the wind was blowing the gas back toward the drilling pad. Repsol is contracting with a company called Wild Well Control out of Texas that specializes in controlling blowouts. Forster says it's not ideal that Repsol lost control of the well, but the potential for significant environmental damage is very small.
And it will have caused some raised blood pressure and some extra expenditure and some delay of time. And, you know, in best case scenario, it will have startled a few people, made them spend a little extra money, and then they go back to work.
Forster says it's been almost two decades since a similar accident happened on the North Slope. She says Repsol was required to complete a comprehensive shallow survey of the geology before drilling to look for potential hazards.
Our technical staff looked at it, analyzed it. I reviewed it, and our geologic commissioner looked at it as well. So it had quite a few eyes on it, and none of us identified shallow hazards. So all that shows is that you can't predict everything.
Environmental groups say that fact should convince the state to proceed cautiously into new drilling areas. Lois Epstein is Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, and she says the state is lucky the blowout involved gas and not oil, and the accident is a reminder that drilling wells is still risky.
This is a very dirty, complex business, and because that's the reality, it's incredibly important to protect sensitive areas and not have them subject to drilling.
Epstein says if a large-scale version of the Repsol accident happened offshore in Alaska, it would be disastrous for marine life. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission already has a field inspector on the scene. The Department of Environmental Conservation expects to have someone there today. Alaska lawmakers yesterday passed a bill exempting political candidates who do not have a computer or internet access at home from the state's electronic campaign disclosure requirement. House Bill 311 also delays implementation of the rule for 1 year until February 2013 and prevents the Alaska Public Offices Commission from changing reporting requirements during a campaign cycle. A Senate amendment exempting anyone who has previously filed under different reporting requirements did not make it into the final bill. By passing the legislation yesterday, lawmakers were trying to avoid costly fines for being out of compliance with the rule. Yesterday was the deadline for candidates to file year-end disclosure reports for 2011 and year start reports for this year. Several lawmakers have complained that APOC's electronic reporting system is slow, cumbersome, and hard to use. Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker says the bill also fixes deficiencies in the reporting requirement that could prevent some people from running for office.
The bill makes certain that every Alaskan has an equal opportunity to run for office. It makes certain that we don't have a technology test, a literacy test. It makes certain that we don't impose a wealth requirement. We don't disenfranchise the more impoverished people in our community. And it also makes certain that we don't disadvantage rural and pioneer lifestyles by saying that if you don't have an internet connection, you can still run for office and file reports. We don't make you go out and get an internet connection in order to run for office.
Members of the Alaska Public Offices Commission came out against House Bill 311 on Tuesday, saying it would reduce transparency. APOC Executive Director Paul Dauphiné was already on record with his staff's concerns. House Bill 311 now heads to Governor Sean Parnell for his potential signature. Southeast Alaska salmon seiners could vote on a reduction to the fleet this year. The federal government is reviewing a proposed buyback program that could remove 64 permits from the limited entry fishery. Final approval is up to the fleet itself. Joe Vicknicki has the story.
The program would pay just over $13 million to buy out 64 seine permits. Those permit holders would be paid from a federal loan that would be repaid by the rest of the seine fleet. Mike Sturtevant, Fishing Capacity Reduction Program Manager with NOAA Fisheries in Silver Springs, Maryland, explains.
What the permit holders will be voting on is whether they want to take on the $13 odd million of debt here, pay out these permit holders that we're buying out, and the people left in the fishery have to pay up to 3% fee on future landings until the loan's paid off. So they really, that's what they're ultimately voting on, is what they're we're buying out worth at 3% cost.
Congress approved the buyback program about 5 years ago. The legislation allows for a loan of over $23 million, which could cover the current proposal and more reductions later. A pilot program 3 years ago removed 35 permits from the fishery, leaving 380. During last year's season of big catches and high prices, a little over two-thirds of those permits were actually fished. To conduct the buyback, a fishing organization called the Southeast Revitalization Association held a reverse auction for fleet members who wanted to sell their permits. And the group Southeast Alaska Saners Association has posted a list of willing sellers on its blog. The proposed sale prices range from $175,000 to $240,000. Not many sane permits have been up for sale because of the buyback program. Those that did went for anywhere from $138,000 up to $153,000, according to the broker Petersburg Fisherman Services. Bobby Thorstensen is executive director of the Saners Association and has been pushing for the buyback. He says the number of permit holders out fishing is on the rise, and he expects it to keep going up.
While the fishery keeps chugging along, the more boats we add to the fishery, the less the guys that are remaining are going to just not catch as much fish, and they're not going to get as much fishing time, and they're not going to make a living. This last year, guys made a living, but in the last decade, in the last 10 years, the average purse seiner hasn't really made much of a living.
Thorstensen says boats are also bigger now and have improved efficiency since the early days of the seine fishery. He says the fleet's catching capacity is too large and should be reduced. Meanwhile, opponents say the buyback has already boosted permit prices and made it more difficult for young people to enter the fishery. Others say there's no point in paying to remove permits that aren't being fished. And still others oppose it because it will mean fewer deckhand jobs. Permit holder Clyde Curry of Petersburg has been seining for more than four decades and says he'll vote against the program as it's currently written. He doesn't like the idea of reducing the political voice of the fleet.
There aren't a whole lot of us to start with, and I don't see why it should be good to have a whole bunch less of us, particularly if harvest is going to be high and value is going to be high.
Curry thinks market economics can keep boat numbers down on the fishing grounds instead of a buyback. NOAA Fisheries has received the proposed buyback plan and still has to approve it. The agency's Sturtevant says they hope to do a quick review.
We don't want to delay this any longer, so hopefully we'll be coming to a decision point here within the agency soon whether we approve the plan and move forward with the referendum as quickly as we can after that.
If it's approved, the referendum could be mailed out sometime this spring. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
A person on contract to deliver the mail in Fairbanks has been sentenced to 6 months in jail for hiding more than 100 pieces of mail in a storage locker. 40-year-old Christopher Thomas already changed his plea on a misdemeanor charge of misapplying property. Felony perjury charge was dismissed. Thomas worked on contract to deliver the mail between 2005 and 2008. He had 120 pieces of first-class mail, one piece of international mail, and one tub of pre-sorted standard mail stored in a storage unit. Thomas was the second postal worker to recently face charges for not delivering mail. A North Pole postal worker is scheduled to enter a guilty plea next month.